Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. And welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Andrew F. Jones, who's professor in Chinese at the University of California, Berkeley. And he'll be talking about his new book, Circuit Listening, Chinese Popular Music in the Global 1960s, which was published last year, 2020, by University of Minnesota Press. Music from East Asia is today arguably a bigger part of the global soundscape than ever, and those who have suddenly found Psy, Zhao Fangjing, or BTS bursting into their sonic experiences might think of this trend as something completely new. However, as Andrew Jones shows in Circuit Listening, popular music from East Asia, and in this book it's a variety of Chinese languages and musical styles that are focused on, has been moving around for a long time, and perhaps never more importantly than during that most epochal of musical decades, the 1960s. Jones's book pays close attention to the questions of genre, periodization, and style, which emerge from considering the astonishing range of popular music production in the geopolitically divided spaces of Taiwan, China, and Hong Kong at this time. But the book is about a lot more than particular performers or songs. In order to understand the diffusion of different musical trends in these places and the connections and disjunctures between them, the book argues that we must study the circuits, geographical, cultural, and electronic, around which music moves. From recording and broadcasting of sound enabled by transistors and vinyl presses, to networks of record smugglers, socialist propaganda speakers, and diasporic Chinese businesses in Southeast Asia, Jones tunes in to these technological, economic, social, and geopolitical currents which propelled Sinophone popular music around East Asia and beyond. As a result, the book offers not only a rich compendium of research into megastars such as Grace Chan and Teresa Teng, and lesser-known genres of Taiwanese musical theatre and folk, but also a whole framework for understanding better the shifts in globalization and communication, which make it possible today, for example, for Ed Sheeran to have apparently written a song for the new BTS album. But the author is here to tell us a lot more about all of this, although maybe not BTS specifically. I'll say then, Andrew Jones, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, likewise, it's a great pleasure to talk to you on a topic which, you know, I have, considerable amateur interest in. But before we dive into the kind of themes of the book and so on, perhaps I could begin by asking you how you got here. You've worked very extensively on Chinese music at large. So how did this particular project grow out of that long experience?
Well, strangely enough, I was never trained in musicology or ethnomusicology. Instead, I did my doctorate in Chinese literature, focusing on modern Chinese literature. But I've always been really fascinated by sound, and especially recorded music as a kind of portal into understanding history, cultural history, linguistics, a whole panoply of different issues. So over my career, I've ended up doing quite a lot of work on Chinese popular music, starting from the sort of emergence of rock music in the 1980s in mainland China, to the origins of recorded music and popular music in Shanghai in the 1920s in the so-called Chinese Jazz Age. And then finally, this book, which in a way sort of sits in between those two earlier books, Like a Knife, which was about the 1980s, and Yellow Music about the 1920s and 30s. This is sort of a mid-century book that maybe squares a circle and takes on the task of completing a trilogy of books about modern Chinese music in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, and it also does something, I don't know, not to reduce the projects that you mentioned, the other two books, but it does something in some ways a good deal more complicated because perhaps this region on which you're focusing is so much more evenly riven by sort of divides and influences and moving in less clear directions, perhaps, than those first two books. Would you say that's the case, that this is a more challenging project than those, or is that too simplistic?
I think that makes sense. In one way, or I should say in two ways, this book came out of, it's a sort of amalgamation of two book projects I had in mind earlier. The first one was to write something not about yellow music, but about red music, that is the revolutionary music of Mao's China. Mm-hmm. So I had that in mind, but at the same time, I'm a fairly, wide or, I don't know, promiscuous music listener. I'm fascinated by the music of the 1960s globally. And I started to notice that really across the world, in places like Brazil or Jamaica or Nigeria or, Cambodia, there's this kind of upsurge of local folk musics being kind of cross-hybridized with rock and roll or soul or globally circulating new popular musics of that era. And, at first I was really interested in this sort of cross-pollination between music from the countryside and these new urban electrified musics in the 1960s. And it starts with all sorts of folk revivals in many different countries, not just the UK and the US, and winds up kind of producing this efflorescence of amazing new genres in the period. So not only folk rock, again, in the UK or in the United States with Bob Dylan and et cetera, but also in Russia and or things like High Life in Nigeria, ska, rocksteady, and reggae in Jamaica, forró or Tropicália in Brazil. So in one way, I wanted to write this book to kind of grapple with the larger question of 1960s global pop music and what happened to kind of facilitate this flowering of, to my mind and to my ears, really beautiful and fascinating sonic textures and forms of musical expression worldwide. So I suppose I'm looking at the Chinese speaking world also as a portal or a core sample of a larger global phenomena in that period.
Well, you definitely weave through or weave together these different currents, and I think maybe those original two book ideas or different kind of projects very artistically here and very kind of convincingly into a whole, whilst also not, I think it's almost a bit unsatisfying when books are too neatly sealed up and kind of hard to get in, and there are plenty of things to explore here which maybe continue to ask questions about to what extent we can speak about the 1960s as this sort of coherent period and so on. But we'll jump into those questions, I think, as we go. I'll start. I mean, you kind of take us into that moment. I think, if someone were to say, what was some important global music from the 1960s, it's a counterintuitive entry point to take this Maoist era song, The East is Red, as the entry point to that. But that's where the introduction begins here. So you kind of line up the sort of discussion of this song, The East is Red, by discussing its broadcast from China's first satellite, then draw us towards a comparison of this song with the Beatles' All You Need Is Love. So could you tell us perhaps why that, sort of what that captures about where this project went? As you say, you've given us a bit of background as to how it kind of came together, but what does The East is Red do for us as an entry point here?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I only kind of came up with that song, and that satellite broadcasts as an entry point as I was finishing up the book and writing the introduction, which, you know, comes last mm-hmm. as you're trying to get a handle on the entirety of the book and the story it's telling. One of the starting points of the book is whether you can look at a historical era like the 1960s and identify anything coherent that brings it all together, right? And that's by no means an obvious yes. In fact, what we see in the 60s is a very fragmented world that's characterized by the Cold War, whether it's the Iron Curtain in Europe or the Bamboo Curtain in East Asia, by national division, by the Vietnam War, by all kinds of conflicts. So is there any way that we could say that there's a coherent 1960s sound? And I think the gambit or the wager that the book takes is that we could look at underlying technologies as a common denominator mm-hmm. and an underlying kind of globalization of communication technologies. So the satellite example tries to work with that a little bit. Of course, conventionally speaking, nothing could be more different ideologically, musically, formally, aesthetically than the Beatles' All You Need Is Love and a song like The East Is Red, which was kind of anthemic, massive folk song made into a Maoist anthem that kind of dominated the soundscape of Maoist China at that time. So I just start off by pointing out that actually both of these songs are characterized, yes, of course, by how they sound and what they do politically, but even more so that they're both created really for the widest possible dissemination. And they were kind of inconceivable as they were heard and as they were produced without the technologies that supported them. So in China, that would be a massive loudspeaker network that kind of sounded out the passions and the propaganda of the Maoist regime in the 1960s, even to the point of being amplified into outer space when China launches in 1970 the Dongfang Hong satellite into space, and it broadcasts back to Earth that melody. Da, 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 da. Well, I won't replicate the entire song, but it's basically a diode transistor playing that little melody back to Earth and I guess out into the cosmos as a clarion call for international or I guess outer national revolution as well. But interestingly enough, the Beatles song All You Need Is Love, which also has its own global ambitions or global pretensions, was written and performed for the first global satellite television broadcast in 1967. So there's an odd parallelism between the two songs, despite their manifest differences. And I think that theme plays out throughout the book, that we may have manifestly different pop music cultures in Taiwan or in Hong Kong or mainland China, but in fact, they're all supported by the same revolutionary new technology, which is the transistor circuit. And they play out in different ways, but the reach of the music, the way the music sounds, the way it's reproduced, the way that people are able to listen to it are all determined in part by that underlying technology. Although the application of the technology does differ according to different political conditions or political circuits, using the phraseology from the book, as well as linguistic conditions and ideological imperatives of the period.
Right, right. And yeah, as you say, that circuit kind of works analogously on a couple of different levels, which we'll come on to presently, I think. But I guess before that, you've already alluded to these kind of different geopolitical spaces. And I think another thing that we ask, or we might ask about the 1960s as a coherent period globally, is centered on the idea of revolution, for example, right? The kind of course, the Beatles represent a certain kind of revolution in one part of the world, whilst, you know, Dongfang Hong, East is Red, is another sort of revolutionary, as you said, a sort of clarion call. How much do you think we can speak or to what extent is this sort of role of revolution, of social revolution, as well as technological revolution, and the big social forces that drove, you know, everything from the 1960s experience of, for example, Britain, or indeed London, because I don't think even all of Britain got it, and North America, and also drove things like the Cultural Revolution. So where do kind of revolutionary events fit into your understanding of this global 1960s, or indeed otherwise?
Yeah, it's hugely important and fascinating for when it does take place, as in the Cultural Revolution in China, and also where, in a decade that's characterized by revolution, where it really doesn't seem to be taking place, as in Taiwan, where you have a pretty firmly counter-revolutionary, if I can put it that way, or authoritarian anti-communist regime under Chiang Kai-shek. So there are a number of different kinds of revolutions that I was interested in here. And one of them is actually a little bit more perhaps economically or structurally fundamental than the outward trappings of, say, a socialist revolution, and that's the Green Revolution. And I was inspired in this in part by Frederick Jameson's analysis of the 1960s called Periodizing the 1960s, where he says that, among other things, the 60s is characterized by a deepening of decolonization worldwide. But one of the things that's happening on the ground, and especially in rural areas, is Green Revolution, whereby new technologies, new fertilizers, new strains of rice cultivars are really kind of, well, here's the word again, revolutionizing agricultural production, and in many cases rendering labor and rural laborers extraneous. And so what you see all over the world in the 1960s is a kind of convulsive growth of big cities mm-hmm. like Sao Paulo or Kingston or Taipei, and a massive new lurch forward in terms of industrialization. So one of the premises of the book was that I wanted to look at the 1960s not only from the metropolitan perspective of a London or a San Francisco Bay Area or Paris, but from the peripheries of southern Taiwan, or what's happening in the countryside in China. And what we see there is, actually, in most areas outside of mainland China, you see urbanization and a new kind of traffic that's also facilitated by portable transistor radios and vinyl records between rural music and urban music, especially as rural migrants pour into cities like Taipei. So that's one revolution that I think is really important for this period. Another one is the transistor revolution, that means that places that still don't have electrical mains now have access to media, to, you know, transistor radios and to record players, because transistors are light enough and cheap enough and demand less electricity than tube electronics, which means that you can have battery-powered radios and battery-powered wired radio networks in the case of China. So that's another kind of revolution that enables new sounds to circulate much more rapidly from the countryside to the city and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, yeah, there's the dominant fact of the socialist revolution or the ongoing Maoist revolution in China that really deeply shapes the aesthetics of music in that period and daily life in that period, and even the media system in that period, which is, again, characterized by a centralized system that then kind of, in a capillary fashion, moves out across the countryside through wired broadcasting networks that bring the voice of the party to even the remote hinterlands. So that's one kind of revolution. And then in Taiwan, as I mentioned, there's also a kind of anti-communist regime that's involved in really on the front lines of the Cold War. So yeah, all of those revolutions are present, and I hope at least partly accounted for in the book. Another interesting notion that I play around with, especially in the chapter about Maoist songs, is the way that Maoist media also move not only within China, but into a global circuit of young people for instance, Maoist revolutionaries in Paris or in Berkeley, who kind of tune into Radio Peking, or tune into Maoist quotation songs and other forms of Maoist media. So that particular circuit is, you know, well, largely based in or produced in a sort of closed media space of the People's Republic of China. There are ways in which it is also globalized through kind of media circuits that move across, move laterally across the world.
And yeah, I mean, there's a lot you say that's very fascinating about how we might understand some of these, pithy, very catchy, but also, sort of, I don't know, haunting kind of rhythms or songs from the Maoist period, how we think of those as pop or how we might think of those as pop. It's that there are some very interesting things you say about that that I hope we'll come on to. There's also, you know, a significant part of the book dedicated specifically to Taiwan, which you've already raised, and you know, I think as a place that sits in opposition to that Maoist kind of paradigm, also an awful lot to say about this broader picture. But you begin in chapter one with somewhere that isn't either of those places, I guess, or somewhere that sits under that still colonial kind of colonial domination and control by Britain, namely Hong Kong. So how does this location tell us something about this idea, which you've already alluded to, circuits, circulation of musical styles and genres? And your focus here is on the personage of Grace Chan in particular. So why is she significant, and how does this help us understand this notion of circuits, which you've already brought up?
Right. So I think the genesis of that particular notion about circuit listening actually arose out of my grappling with Grace Chan's music. And I mean, one thing I can say about the book in general is each of the chapters really started with my encounter with an LP record or vinyl record. So in this case, I had found a Capitol Records release of Grace Chan's music that was put out in the United States as part of a kind of world music before we had the phrase world music series that Capitol Music was doing. Capitol Records, coincidentally, but I think significantly, was also the company in the US that promoted the Beatles, or created the Beatles boom in the US. So they did a Grace Chan record.
I should ask you, the cover of the book, actually very beautiful and striking, has these record covers on it. Are these from your personal collection, or are these other covers that feature on the book itself?
Most of them are from a personal collection. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. It's very, very striking.
Right. And some of the colored plates in the center of the book are also, personal collection or records that were particularly significant in, surveying the musical terrain of the period. Right. So Grace Chan's really interesting. She kind of is a remnant in some sense, or a inheritor of the Shanghai modern songs, or should I true tradition of of modern pop music from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And then she was born in that region, I believe in Nanjing, and then emigrated to Hong Kong after the or maybe just before the Communist Revolution in 49. So she carried on the torch of an earlier tradition of Shanghai popular music. But when you listen to that record, the Capitol Music, Capitol Records, Hong Kong's Grace Chan record, I found it really interesting because the traces of that earlier idiom of kind of jazz inflected Chinese Mandarin pop songs from the 30s and 40s, but also very conspicuously, there's mambo music, and Grace Chang kind of made a name for herself as the mambo girl in Hong Kong cinema. There were calypso songs and various other sorts of, Hollywood inflected show tune style kind of music. And I was thinking, Hong Kong's Grace Chang, but musically, this is a real, strange mix of styles and genres. And I was especially struck by the presence of mambo and calypso. So how is it that Afro-Caribbean music becomes so important to Hong Kong's Grace Chan? So the idea I hit upon is to kind of try to map that record and to realize that Grace Chang couldn't really be captured by or encapsulated by Hong Kong itself. Or to put it in the obverse way, maybe Hong Kong itself is a space of movement or circulation or a node of circulation between really radically far-flung musical styles and ideologies, right? So if this star who represents Hong Kong is also the Mambo girl, the Calypso girl, also an avatar of Shanghai popular music, which itself was influenced by Hawaiian music and jazz, as well as local Chinese folk tunes, then how do we kind of, you know, understand her as representing a singular place? We can't really. She represents a network or a node of a network of global musical circulations. So that's kind of the one of the directions or trajectories that I was launched on by Grace Chang and her wonderful singing voice, as well as her role in Hong Kong cinema, and especially Hong Kong musical cinema at that time, which had its own network of distribution across Southeast Asia and the Chinese diaspora.
Mm. And she sings in Mandarin as well, which you notice significant. What is sort of important about that in the, you know, in the Hong Kong context, and then in that sort of broader world within which her productions circulated?
Right. So since the 1920s and 30s, Hong Kong, of course, had its own Cantonese language film industry and pop music industry. But after the revolution and the kind of widespread immigration of capital, expertise, and media companies from Shanghai to Hong Kong in the 1950s, a kind of Mandarin film industry and a Mandarin pop music industry springs up and becomes really dominant in Hong Kong space, and also uses that vision of a national language and a coherent national Chinese identity to project outwards to the Chinese diaspora as well. So the height of that is companies like MPNGI, which was a Singapore-based kind of movie-making conglomerate, as well as the Shaw Brothers, which is, of course, a very famous film studio on the kind of Hollywood model that flourished in Hong Kong in the 60s. And both of them relied on Mandarin as a kind of lingua franca. And I think actually probably a lot of the executives and filmmakers and creatives involved in that industry were very much shaped by a notion of projecting a unified Chinese national language and identity out to the world, even out into a space that was still and remains, of course, now fractured by linguistic difference, even in the so-called Sinophone world, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, Mandarin at that moment did become a very powerful passport to move across national borders or to create a unifying voice across a fractured geopolitical landscape. Mm. Right. And I think Grace Chang was very much part of that and relied on that for her musical identity.
Right. And I think, yeah, you convey very well that sort of almost paradoxical relationship between that effort to unify, to kind of forge some sort of coherent cultural, you know, if not political space, whilst also, you know, with using a product or by means of an extremely heterogeneous musical form or selection of musical forms, as well as, cinematic output and stuff, which I should say, you know, you pay extremely close attention to in the book itself. So the way that you marry together this detailed sort of textual attention to the actual music, the listening, you talk a lot about your work as an act of listening. I think that certainly holds up as something which is very close to the ground and yet also, yeah, attuned, if that's not too weak a pun, to the broader currents of circulation and geopolitics.
Yeah, I think that's right. In the chapter on Grace Chang, I talk a lot about a film called Air Hostess, Kong Zhong Xiao Jie, from 1959, which is kind of a vehicle, as it were, an aviation vehicle for Grace Chang's own popularity. Mm-hmm. But it also traces very closely the network, the business network, or the business infrastructure for both the MPNGI, the film company that made the film, as well as Pathé Records, that was by then based in Hong Kong, that was projecting the music for the film out to its markets. And they visit precisely the places that are markets for the film and for Grace Chang's music, which would be, you know, Bangkok, Singapore, Taiwan. So this air hostess that is played by Grace Chang visits and kind of replicates and reproduces and promotes her own fame throughout the film. And the songs themselves, well, there's, again, calypso and mambo and a variety of different styles, but they are all sort of assimilated to this task of projecting a product, as well as, I think, a project of an ideology of free China, as opposed to red China. Free China is a space of commerce and of capitalism.
Yeah. Right, which suits that, I guess, Southeast Asian maritime world quite well too. But from there you move on to Red China, as we like to call it, and more red music, if you like. The space from which from which Grace Chang left to go to Hong Kong, and you take us, you know, into what, at least as you say, as we've already mentioned briefly, seems like an extremely different kind of cultural and of course social space. So could you talk about the particular songs that you chose to focus on here, these quotation songs, these songs that lift directly from the little red book and Mao's kind of quotations, and why it is that those are helpful in understanding this alternative circuit, I suppose, that existed in the mainland during this period?
Yeah, so this was also a case where finding a used record in a record shop here in Berkeley kind of launched a chapter. I came across a 10-inch vinyl record of Chairman Mao quotation songs. Of course, I was aware of Maoist music and of the Red Song tradition.
It seems like a very Berkeley record shop find. I don't know where else you would come across that in a used record store.
Yeah, Berkeley is actually a very good place for crate digging because of that. There were a lot of radicals and student radicals here in the 60s. So those records are pretty easy to find here, as well as pirate records that circulated from Taiwan and were bought by U.S. GIs, military men. In Taiwan, who brought them back here because this was a port of embarkation and debarkation for soldiers in Vietnam. A lot of the kind of material base for the book came from record stores here. So a shout out to Amoeba Records on Telegraph Avenue that really helped the project along. That particular record, the quotation songs, part of me was appalled by it. Because the songs are really shrill and really loud and really deeply kind of insanely repetitive. And, you know, to my ear, they were very grating. And yet after one listen, I was hooked. They're unbelievably effective earworms. You just cannot get them out of your head, right? And after listening for a while, I started to ask myself, why do these records sound this way? Like, why are they so canted up towards the mid-range and upper mid-range? Why are they so screechy? Why is there no bass? But also, by the same token, why are they so formally brilliant as pop songs? Like, I'd never heard songs that could stick so well in my head. And of course, part of the answer is that their songs reduced to the sort of degree zero of songiness, that is, they are all chorus and nothing else. You'll take a quotation from the Little Red Book and repeat it ad infinitum for about a minute and a half, wedded to a pretty catchy little melody, and that's it. Then it's over, and then it repeats, or, you know, rinse and repeat, and replay. I started to kind of do some deeper research into how these songs came about. And they were indeed part of a political campaign to promote the Little Red Book that had been begun by Lin Biao, Chairman Mao's right-hand man, and at the time the head of the PLA, to kind of set the quotations in the Little Red Book, or the quotations from Chairman Mao, to music methodically from number one, the first quotation, all the way through. But one thing that happened is that these songs really started to catch on, especially among Red Guards, and they became popular as songs to perform and reperform with groups of friends, either, you know, with accordion accompaniment or just simply sung chorally. And between 1966 and 1969, they were really quite ubiquitous across the Chinese soundscape, in part because they're so catchy, but of course also they express the tenor and something of the political sense of emergency and of passion that were prevalent in that period. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was fascinating and interesting to also get a handle on why they sounded the way they did in recorded versions. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that they were being engineered to sound good or to travel well over the kind of outdoor, very somewhat rudimentary loudspeaker network that was part of the Chinese mediascape at that time. So those speakers really couldn't accommodate bass at all. They're quite loud. They're engineered to so that the sound could travel well. And basically that tinny or high-pitched, often kind of overdriven, grainy quality of the sound actually is a kind of product of or an artifact of the media system through which it was disseminated and broadcast. So, yeah, that's kind of an example, I suppose, of using listening or close listening as a way to grapple with how the media system was set up or what the technological basis of the media system was. Because those things leave their traces on the music itself.
Absolutely, yeah. So we've got, there's a kind of social dimension there, which weds the presence of a certain kind of music to a certain kind of, I guess, countercultural or revolutionary movement. You know, if we're looking for a kind of parallels there with global 1960s phenomena, I suppose that marriage of these little ditties or tunes with Red Guard activity is one area, but exactly as you say, another is this technological kind of aspect to why it is that music ends up sounding like it does. And so one of the sort of, I guess, purposes of this, or one of the kind of extraordinary achievements in a way, which I think mirrors a sort of Chinese Communist Party achievement, was reaching, you know, the Chinese peasantry, probably, you know, more deeply, more extensively than any government ever in history of China had. And by, you know, I guess, wiring up village loudspeakers, there was a kind of level of penetration there that was quite extraordinary. But you've already mentioned that this was a kind of two-way relationship in some respects between, you know, the countryside in this broader frame and the urbanizing spaces. So where did the tunes, I mean, you mentioned in the introduction about Dongfang Hong, that the original tune for that East is Red song is a shanbei, right? The kind of up on the North China Plain, a kind of folk song. So where were the actual tunes for these quotation songs sourced from? Do you have much sense of that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Many of them were composed by sort of party musicians or people in the kind of upper echelons of the musical enterprise of the communist regime. But as you just brought up and implied, their basis was often in folk music. So Dongfang Hong quite famously was a sort of the product of a long evolution and long kind of upgrading or cultivation of a shanbei folk song. And that's also the case with a lot of the quotation songs that they, as it were, quoted from earlier folk melodies, cut them down to size, made them intensely repetitive, and then married them to Chairman Mao's own words. Occasionally there were funny and interesting emendations. Apparently, the composers who were involved were enjoined, for instance, to always use high pitches for certain keywords like Communist Party. So that changed the melody sometimes. And often they tried to adapt the melodies to the prosody of Chairman Mao's own words. So for instance, if the quotation used chiasmus, a kind of, you know, rhetorical reversal, then the melody itself would mirror that shape in terms of its pitch distribution. it's very fun, actually.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting to look at the songs themselves and look at the kind of notation and how the pitches are distributed. But yeah, a lot of the material is based on folk music. And later on in 1969, when Jiang Qing, Chairman Mao's wife, sort of gained the upper hand along with the Gang of Four, as part of the Gang of Four, she eventually became disillusioned with this form of music because she felt it was too kinetic. That is, it promoted dancing, and dancing for her was tantamount to the kind of swing dancing she would have known in the 1930s back in Shanghai. And she was also bothered that the music was a little bit too folksy. Mm-hmm. She, as is well known, had interests in other forms, such as ballet.
Right.
So in 1969, this particular genre of quotation songs was proscribed and banned, and remained so for the rest of the Cultural Revolution period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I suppose, nevertheless, what it represents is still a pretty tight marriage of kind of central priorities, or urban elite production and the world of the peasantry, the kind of wider Chinese countryside. The formalism of that relationship is still quite tight, I think, relative to the dynamics you describe in the following three chapters, which take us to Taiwan, where I guess a different kind of chaos and flux is afoot with regard to the sort of broader Taiwan music scene. So, and I should say as well, I sense, you know, actually for these chapters, a lot of affection and deep involvement with Taiwan, which I think I gather goes back a fair way with you, with the personal relationships with the various musical figures there too. So that's also very kind of, you know, a very convincing and powerful component of this section of the book. But yes, you take us at first into this genre of Taiwanese musical cinema, and particularly a musical called Goodbye Taipei, starring an actor, Wen Xia. Could you tell us about this musical and its action and its audience? And I guess, you know, relating it to these questions of, I guess, town and country, or, you know, globalization and the shifting kind of political currents too, what light that sheds on what was going on in Taiwan sort of roughly at this period.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's true that I think in some ways the heart of the book, or the core of the book, are a series of chapters on Taiwan music, for a number of reasons. I think one, since the book is very deeply concerned with transistor technology, Taiwan's a great test case. It actually became one of the world's leading manufacturers of transistorized electronics in the late 1960s. So both materially and in terms of its kind of musical culture, it reflects that the themes of the book well. It's also a place that went through, as we all know, a radical economic takeoff in the 60s. It was based on rural to urban migration and rapid industrialization. So all of these convulsive changes are reflected in the music. And Wen Xia, who was one of the great stars of so-called Taiyu, or Taiwanese musical cinema, as well as pop music, is a wonderful example of all of that. He's from Tainan, southern Taiwan. And his persona, at least in his films, was of a rural or southern Taiwanese wanderer, Liu Langhan, who you know, tries to move from the countryside to the city and make it big in a place like Taipei. And a lot of the culture in Taiwanese, which was the local majority language, which was very actively suppressed and marginalized by the KMT or nationalist government in favor of Mandarin. So this kind of marginalized majority culture that was represented by Wen Xia is very much kind of portrayed in this wonderful film, Zaijian Taipei, or Goodbye Taipei, from 1969, which features Wen Xia and his sidekick kind of walking down a country road and walking right into Taipei, and then having a series of kind of picaresque adventures. They're all accompanied by some of Wen Xia's originals, as well as his covers of then globally circulating pop music, both from Japan as well as from the West. So you have like, you know, Blue Tears, Psychedelia, or covers of the Beatles, but also covers of really interesting gender-bending Japanese pop songs from the period. And one thing that interests me about this whole milieu is that for the Taiwanese music and cinema of the period, which was really undercapitalized, these are black and white films, they often have a kind of slapstick, low-budget charm to them. But their cultural reference points are very, very different, I think, from either the mainstream Mandarin culture that was circulating through the Chinese diaspora at this time, or from, you know, of course, mainland Chinese Maoist culture. And that point of reference was really strongly Japanese. And of course, this is a remnant of the suppressed but still really rather vital connection that Taiwan had to Japan after 50 years of colonialism. So Wen Sha and a lot of his colleagues in the Taiwanese music scene, like Hong Yifeng, were known for taking Japanese melodies, pop melodies, and then adapting them with Taiwanese lyrics. And this sort of music was often called Hunxue Gechu, or mixed blood music. So in a way, I would say that Wen Sha, in his case, you know, beyond the fact that the film is delightful and his music is wonderful, also helped to situate Taiwan in a very different kind of linguistic, ideological, and historical circuit. And that's part of what interested me here, that within the same historical period, even in a film that kind of quotes the Beatles or quotes Blue Tear or quotes Otis Redding, you still have an incredibly distinctive and quite disparate cultural formation that emerges beautifully in the music.
Yeah, and you have some really touching reflections on that by a figure that I think we'll come back to in a second, Xu Changhui, kind of prominent, I guess, a critic and scholar of Chinese music, if I've understood correctly, in the appendix to the book, a sort of almost psychogeographical or musical psychogeographical exploration of Taipei at this time, where he's walking around and hearing some of these, as you put it, these hunxue, these sort of Taiwanese language, but Japanese clones or music kind of borrowed from Japan, as well as Japanese originals, as well as some of this sort of Beatles and other Western music. And I think he's sort of amusingly appalled by all of it in that appendix, which you include. Absolutely, I think you document very very well there, that kind of very different sort of milieu set of influences and things that feed into the Taiwanese music scene as embodied by Wen Xia. But I guess, yeah, I mean, on the kind of broader scale, you've mentioned already there that the significance of Taiwan is this place where transistors is a key industry, and where embeddedness in certain circulations, technological circulations, is important. You mentioned that, yeah, vinyl becomes a kind of key, I guess, pirated vinyl becomes a key industry, if not, I guess, promoted by the government, but it becomes something that is very significant to the way that music moves around this region at the time. So could you say something a little bit about why it was that Taiwan became this center of this entrepot of records and pirate production of music?
Yeah, so this, in some sense, I suppose in the book, I framed this, the pirate music industry or the vinyl industry in Taiwan as part of a military circuit. And I think not only in my book, but in work by other scholars looking at, say, South Korea in particular, we see that the presence of U.S. military bases, especially in the 1960s, but really starting from the Korean War as well, became a driver of the importation and the sort of jumping or the leap of Anglo-American pop music into East Asian media circuits. So one of the conduits for that was the U.S. Armed Forces radio that brought the, you know, Billboard top 40 sounds of the U.S. into East Asian airspace. But another really important driver that I have a chapter about was pirate records. And pirate records really, and also pirate books at the time, in Taiwan were really driven by a huge declivity between, the poverty, the still pretty serious poverty of Taiwan and the wealth of the United States. So if you wanted to, say, even buy a record by Beethoven, let alone the Beatles, it would cost anywhere from 10 to 50 times as much if you got the official copy imported from the U.S. So what sprung up in particular in response to the very large population of U.S. service people and administrators and military men in Taiwan was local pressings of, you know, imported records that were then sold around the military bases. But what happens is that initial pirate industry selling to U.S. servicemen mostly starts to scale up and starts to find an audience, especially among young people in a city like Taipei in the around the Zhongshan Road area, where there were a lot of U.S. military installations, but also a lot of kind of hipster bars and cafes. It becomes a kind of a subculture whereby young people get turned on to what's called 热门音乐, or hit music or hot music, however you want to translate it, through these pirate records. And by the late 60s and early 70s, this was a pretty big industry. And it was, of course, flouting copyright conventions or tacitly allowed to do so. But it started to also be an export industry, whereby Taiwan was exporting records to Hong Kong, throughout Southeast Asia. A lot of these records are coming back to the U.S., as I mentioned before, as servicemen buy them there and then take them back. You can still come across them a lot in the U.S. because there were so, you know, hundreds of thousands of records produced. And I look at the industry in the chapter, and it has pretty interesting roots. Some of the expertise that went into making vinyl locally in Taiwan actually came from people who have been trained in mining and with making bakelite out of mining tailings under Japanese colonialism, and then parlay that into this new kind of media industry in the 60s and 70s. And what's also quite fascinating about it is that I do a kind of case study of one company called Di Changpian Gongzi, the First Records, which was a kind of major pirating company. And the money they made in pirating records in the 60s and 70s and then into the early 80s, when the industry kind of tails off as copyrights are applied, is then, I don't want to say laundered, but that's essentially what happens. Money is then reinvested in optical media. And the same company that was a pirate record company in the 60s and 70s becomes the world's largest producer of CD-ROMs and CDs in the 1990s and early 2000s, before that industry goes away because of the internet and digitalization. So yeah, it's kind of an interesting industrial story, but it's also a really compelling, I think, cultural and musical story, because pirate records especially enable the influx of music like rock and roll, but also things like Bob Dylan or Joan Baez into Taiwanese campus life. And are a direct generator of one of the major genres that emerges out of Taiwan in the 70s and 80s, which is campus folk. Now, campus folk also generates the emergence of a legitimate local pop music industry in Taiwan that produces, you know, Su Rei and all the Qi Qing and all the kind of great pop rock singers who then take the mainland by storm once the kind of cassette industry gears up in the 1980s after reform and opening. So there's kind of a direct route between U.S. military bases, pirate records, the later sort of anti-colonial campus folk, and then finally the conquering of the mainland by Taiwanese pop music. Yeah, and I think that's another reason why I had to focus a lot on Taiwan in this book, because Taiwan has had a hugely outsized role also in mainland musical history. And of course, Teresa Tung or Deng Lijun is the great sort of avatar of that history.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, in some ways, you know, it's extraordinary to think of anything much surviving this kind of onslaught of militarized and industrialized sort of processes that unfold around this whole region over the period you've been talking about, you know, even stretching beyond the 1960s. Your description of that Wensha musical film Goodbye Taipei is exactly a sort of monument to something which is going, because that was his last Taiwanese language film. And equally, as you said, that there's a kind of a huge complex of things that are driving these changes towards urbanization and towards, of course, the influxes, as you've said, of global currents of Western pop music and then spawning folk and so on. You do document a really fascinating and important case too, though, of sort of indigenous folk revival in the persona of Chen Da, this folk musician who I think you suggest is sort of came to prominence as a result of a meeting with Xu Changhui, the person who wrote the author of the appendix that you include. Perhaps we don't have time to delve into that too deeply, but I'd say, just to reinforce what you've said about sort of the extraordinary kind of multiplicity of influences on Taiwanese music, and then the outward sort of profusion of it into Chinese language pop space, is really reinforced still further by discussion of that, the sort of, you know, native Taiwanese musical tradition. But we might move on then finally to a figure you've already alluded to here, Teresa Teng, a figure perhaps best known, I don't know if this is true, but among most of the stars that you, or the personae that you focus on, maybe the most famous, I don't know. What does her kind of emergence at exactly this period you've just mentioned there, when the sort of airwaves are opened and Taiwanese music can sort of cross the straits and land in what we've already suggested is a very different sort of musical, technological, and of course geopolitical realm. What does that sort of process tell us about PRC and Taiwanese music and this broader question of connections across this era?
Right. So Teresa Teng, or in Chinese Deng Lijun, really is a pivotal figure, and I think she is very much the best known or most iconic figure that the book tries to understand better, understand in a new light. And in some ways, her emergence in the late 1960s does have a dialectical and quite melancholy relationship with people like Wensha or Chen Da, the great Taiwanese folk troubadour. Because as her star rises, it's rising through the kind of expansion of the television industry and of consumer electronics in Taiwan. And that rise of color TV and Mandarin language media really puts paid to and ends the career of Wensha in that period. So Taiyu cinema is basically destroyed by the rise of television in the early 70s. And a really distinctive local folk musician like Chen Da just doesn't really travel across the gating mechanism that's created by TV and modern media. But at the same time, you have a new ascendant Mandarin pop music that's really represented by Deng Lijun and her Mandarin songs. So in the context of Taiwan, she represents a new mobility and a new kind of Mandarin elite in the popular culture space. What's really distinctive about her story, of course, is she's also the figure who brings Mandarin pop music in the Shanghai tradition or the pre-revolutionary tradition back into mainland China. And as is well known, this happens really not only because of her personal magnetism or her skills as a performer, but really because of a changing media landscape. So I analyze her and her music not so much in terms of her persona, but in terms of her status as a domestic appliance. That is, once people get personal domestic access to cassette radio players and in their homes, the entire status and situation of listening changes radically. And with that comes cassettes of her music coming from Hong Kong and Taiwan. And with that comes a new kind of attention to the voice, and especially to her female voice, and to a different kind of soundscape that wasn't really available in the era of communal loudspeaker listening that we alluded to earlier in the conversation. Mm-hmm. So she, as a kind of media effect, she really transforms listening and transforms the soundscape, private soundscapes of ordinary Chinese citizens starting in the 1970s. First through what's called Ting Di Tai, or listening to enemy radio, and then through the kind of cassette revolution that brings a certain new agency of listening to mainland Chinese music fans. Mm. And so the last chapter in the book kind of traces another interesting dialectic, because Deng Lijun was from a KMT military family, and she was often called upon as a voice of Taiwan or Republic of China propaganda. In fact, on at least two occasions, she went to Jinmen, the island of Jinmen, and broadcast on these like high volume military loudspeaker installations across the straits to the Fujian coast. But what I argue is that those kinds of military networks, fixed military networks, were really feeble compared to the more capillary, more thoroughgoing transformation of the media environment that was created by cassettes and cassette players as they, you know, become widespread and easily available in China. And it's really through that medium that her voice actually travels, not only across the 6 miles between Jinmen and the coast, the Xiamen coast in Fujian, but deep, deep, deep into the Chinese countryside and you know, widely disseminated through Chinese cities. And that really takes place in the late 70s and early 80s. Mm-hmm. And then opens up again the mainland Chinese market to what were called in China, Gangtai Gechu, or Hong Kong and Taiwan pop.
Mm. And we might wonder, I suppose, whether the audiences were particularly attuned to these particularities of voice that you mentioned by the fact that they're sort of previous to that, their listening experiences had been also through, very kind of oral only medium, this kind of authorless broadcasting of some of the red songs and the quotation songs that you mentioned. You mentioned that, for her early sort of career in China, if you call it a career, but her appearance in China was as a voice, not as a, people didn't know what she looked like. They only heard
but not seen.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. This really fascinates me that there was a kind of spectral quality to her voice in China, especially at first, when people really would tune in surreptitiously to listen to her voice. Mm. And what we find in accounts of that early and intense close listening to her voice, in private, with the curtains drawn and often with the sound very low, so that you had to kind of put your ear next to the radio or maybe use an earpiece to listen because it was still forbidden to do so. We actually hear a really intense attention to timbre, to the tonal quality of her voice, and it stands in such powerful contrast to the kinds of timbres and the kind of tonal qualities that were prevalent in revolutionary music. And I think that's part, an interesting part of the story is the way the situation of listening kind of spurs people to close listening and a very kind of emotionally effusive kind of listening in that transition between media regimes.
Right. And it's for that reason that I think for all that people wouldn't necessarily want to be called an appliance or an acoustic effect, as you put it in the book, I think it makes that way of understanding the figure of Theresa Teng or Deng Lijun very persuasive because of exactly the background you trace, and I think adds to this convincing portrayal of this era as one which wherein it is as important to consider the kind of the connections, the coherence, as well as the disjunctures and declivities, all of which you've documented extremely well here. But Andrew, we've had a good chat here, and I have to say there's plenty more in the book that we haven't covered. So, of course, I'd urge listeners to get out and get hold of a copy in order to delve deeper into all of these topics. But before we close up completely, I'd ask you where your ears or any other, senses have taken you and what your next projects have been after this book.
Well, currently it seems that I've stumbled into perhaps writing a new book about Jamaican popular music that relies perhaps in part on the methodologies or the trains of thought that I developed in circuit listening. So I've already written a couple essays about the development of reggae. And part of the point of entry, which may interest listeners to this podcast, is the really quite remarkable role that Hakka Chinese migrants to Jamaica played in the production and even the aesthetic development of that really powerful Afro-Jamaican musical form. So that's one project I'm working on musically. And beyond that, well, I just continue to write about modern Chinese literary topics and work on literary translations of some of my favorite Chinese stylists.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, yeah, I think we'll look forward to tuning in, indeed, to those other future projects. And I think if there's one thing you've shown here, it's that it's hard to understand any of these musical sort of trajectories or histories in isolation. So certainly people, I think, should be interested in reaching out to Jamaica and beyond. Thank you very much, Andrew, though. It's been wonderful talking to you today, and I'm really grateful for you appearing on the show.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Listeners, thank you too, as ever, for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.